Right.
Is he quite famous?
So Leonardo Bruni is quite famous, actually. Okay. He's become more and more famous in the course of the past 25 years, I would say. Especially thanks to the work of James Hankins, who is, as you can see, one of the editors of this volume, and who in fact wrote the selection that you read for today, the one on philosophy and Bruni, and also did the translation of that piece. He was my supervisor for the PhD. Mm-hmm. And one of his bailiwicks, if I may say so, is Leonardo Bruni and his importance in the 15th and 16th centuries. And he's produced a very important and long and very detailed inventory of the works that he wrote and the manuscripts associated with them and the printed editions. Well, that's coming out, but the first volume is the manuscripts. And one of his main theses has been that actually this person, who may not be a household name to many people doing Renaissance today, was actually very, very important, not only in his own time, but later on. So what are some of the names that immediately come to mind when, if you're thinking about Renaissance thought? Are probably two or three names that come to mind to you, just off the bat.
What do you mean?
It doesn't matter if they're wrong.
Cosimo.
Cosimo de' Medici, yes. Okay, Cosimo the Elder as a patron of a lot of the thinkers.
There's some Niccolo, isn't there?
Are you thinking about Niccolo Niccoli?
Mm.
Oh, that's interesting that you know him. Not really a household name to a lot of people. Anyone else?
No.
You're probably missing the most famous.
Alberti.
Oh, Alberti is very famous too. Very good. Sandra saying, who's Alberti? Leon Battista Alberti, the architect. And the writer of literature. Yep. And what other household names for Renaissance thought?
Did you just say Vasari?
Nope, we didn't say Vasari. Vasari is a very important theoretician of art history in the 16th century, that's right. How about this guy?
Somebody obvious.
Yeah.
Aristotle.
Yeah, but
what is
it? Pico. Della Mirandola, right?
Oh, yeah.
Have you not heard of Peacock? Lisa.
No.
I am really. Okay.
Only in here.
Pico della Mirandola. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Guess where he came from? From Mirandola. Yes, okay. Yeah. And he's probably the best known Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, to be distinguished from his nephew. Yes. This is Anna Laura Pugliapito, by the way, who is one of our research fellows on the ERC, Aristotle and the Vernacular Project, and who will be teaching you next week. And so she just wants to make sure that she responds appropriately to issues that I raise, because I'm talking about Aristotelianism and the Renaissance,
yeah, exactly.
And she's going to talk about anti-Aristotelianism and the Renaissance. So she's obviously got to pick her targets very carefully, including me, of course. Yeah. So Giovanni Piccolo da Mirandola may be one of the best known thinkers, who is also known especially for what's called his Oration. Is that how you spell Oration? Oration on the Dignity of Man, it's called in English. Of course, he didn't write it in English. But that oration, written in Latin, as it happens, actually did have that title, On the Dignity of Man, when it was published. But never mind, it's now nowadays it's referred to as the Oration on the Dignity of Man. And one of the points that he makes is that man is a creature, man in a generic sense, yeah, a creature who actually is suspended between the gods and the earth, earthly elements, right, and is able to ascend or descend the ladder of being, so to speak, in a very effective way. Not a new thought at all, right? because that goes back to Neoplatonism and what had been already suggested in 3rd and 4th century after Christ. But he brings back some of those elements and re-elaborates a new package, let's say, of how man's dignity should be considered. And that's something to be considered, especially within the framework of the topic that we're also going to be talking about today, which is humanism, which some of you have heard about in the past. How many of you have heard me, not heard me talk about humanism? Sorry. You haven't. Okay. So some of this material may ring bells for the others, but actually we're coming to it from a different perspective anyway. So I don't think you'll feel cheated by the end. If you do, that's okay. Throw eggs or tomatoes or whatever. Okay. Okay. Right. So what we're talking about today then are the links between Renaissance humanism and Aristotelianism. And before we get so far as humanism, we have to go back just a little bit and remind ourselves about what was happening in the medieval period in terms of the classical tradition, because this course, after all, does have to do with re-elaborations of antiquity, right? And what happens to Aristotle after Aristotle dies in, what was it, 322 BC, is something quite interesting. Anyone know?
Well, it was suggested, I thought in the reading it was suggested he got lost and he came to Bruni where they found him again.
Okay, I don't know how lost Aristotle got, but in the afterlife. But certainly what happens is that whereas Plato's works continue to be well studied in antiquity, and you have, who's the most famous person that you can think of in antiquity who maybe rephrases Plato's works?
Cicero?
He does in part, yeah. Cicero and someone else, a Christian who comes after him.
Augustine?
Yep. Absolutely. So Cicero and Augustine are actually very good at synthesizing Platonism and other ancient currents of philosophy. Aristotle's works seem to have stayed, literally, in someone's basement for centuries. Really centuries, until someone around Cicero's time actually found them and started going through them again. So we can only imagine what state they were in. These are all bit anecdotes. We don't know the exact story. But so he does influence a little bit the writings of Cicero. You do have elements of Ciceronianism, of Aristotelianism in there. But after Cicero and after Christ, actually the main ancient philosopher who seems to be someone that they can Christians can relate to is Plato, because Plato has a very strong idea of the afterlife, right? And he has also a very strong idea that there is a distinction between an invisible world, which has interesting and important concepts such as, notice the capitals, justice, beauty,
yes,
truth. Is this coming back to someone? Yeah? And that those, that actually the present world is an imperfect reflection of those things. Anyway, these elements are aspects that people can readily relate to as Christians, because Christianity also talks about the invisible spiritual world, the present world as being a very distant imitation, pale imitation, and degenerate imitation, really, of the ideal, right? So Plato becomes quite important for people such as Plotinus and others who are called the Neoplatonists, although in fact they often try to merge elements of Platonism with Aristotelianism. Yeah. And then of course you have another very important person called Boethius. I once knew all of his first names. I think he had five first names. Anno Manilio Severino. This is what they had us learn in school. All of his first names. And he's a Christian philosopher of the 5th century who actually functions as a very, very important conduit of both Platonic ideas and Aristotelian ideas. Platonic ideas in his work called The Consolation of... Come on, help me.
Philosophy.
Yeah, you know it. Very good. Lisa's going to go out and buy this.
I have it.
You have it? Have you read it?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
Not past a few pages.
Okay, so Lisa's going to go home and read it.
Yes.
Tonight.
And do the session next week.
Yeah.
At Anna's turn, I wouldn't be able to go home.
The Consolation of Philosophy. It's not a long work.
No.
It's a dialogue. It's actually quite interesting. And what else does he do for Aristotelianism? Anyone know? Anna Laura should know. If you don't, you don't know?
No.
Are you serious?
Yes.
You don't know? Goodness me. The people we hire as research fellows. He translates all of the logical works of Aristotle. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's the fundamental, most important channel of Aristotle's works in the West. But remember, these are the logical works. So these are things such as on topics and other aspects of logic, how you construct the syllogism properly, right?
If he's translating Aristotle's logical works, why is he called a Neoplatonist?
Good question. He's a Neoplatonist because, although he's interested in Aristotle's logic, for the rest of his philosophy, we're talking about ethics, metaphysics, he's actually much more interested in taking Plato and reconciling him with Christianity. So in The Consolation of Philosophy, which Lisa's going to read, she'll see that actually Plato and Christianity get reconciled in a very amicable way.
Good.
So you have, on the one hand, this strand of Platonism married with Christianity, and on the other hand, the works of logic, which are fundamental, because if you want to know anything, this is one of the reasons why our politicians can't actually solve the problems of Brexit, they haven't studied logic. You have to do translation, study Aristotle's logical works, right? And there's no sense pretending that you can turn a square into a circle or vice versa, right? But Theresa May's trying. Maybe she'll manage, who knows. Okay, so this is really fundamental to thinking about what happens later on, because I said Boethius is 5th century, he dies, when does he die? 522, something thereabouts. Later on, Aristotle's, the only works by Aristotle that are actually studied and known in the West are these logical ones. And Plato's works actually aren't circulating very largely either. There are only 2.5 dialogues of his works that are circulating. Although at the same time you have indirect channels such as The Consolation of Philosophy, Augustine, which, as we said, is full of Platonism, Cicero's works, and so on. Okay? And there's a whole pseudo, how can we call it, pseudo literature. Dionysius the Areopagite, who turns up in the Book of Acts in the New Testament as a convert to Christianity. Presumably, supposedly, he wrote letters. He didn't. Right? And those letters are full of Platonic and Christian elements, which is a nice and interesting thing to know about. Okay, so you have these two strands going along. What is the problem for anyone who has actually read any of the works of Plato with taking those works and teaching them, you think? What's their format? Do you remember?
Dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you go in and teach someone a dialogue? Does that work? No. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you want to teach someone philosophical doctrine, you have them read an essay or a book or something, a treatise, right? Plato just doesn't work as, you know, he's great to read, wonderful writing, even in translation, sounds good, but it's problematic. So if in the 13th century, we're really, really pulling ahead here, but stop me if you have any questions along the way. Who's the most important translator of Aristotle's works? Anna Laura, in the 13th century?
I don't know.
Sure you know.
No, you know. I don't know. And me?
Oh, Grosseteste.
Remember the guy down the road?
Oh, Grosseteste.
Yeah, in Oxford. Merton College. Yeah? Remember him? No.
Before my time.
Okay. Yes, left when we go. Okay. So Robert is who he was. Robert Grosseteste of Merton College, Oxford. Had the brilliant idea that there needed to be a new kind of curriculum in place for the rising universities. The universities were sprouting up in the 12th, 13th centuries. They were there for the benefit of a new professional class, which was needed because the cities were rising up and needed literate people who actually could manage manage the economy and law and so forth, right? And these people needed, therefore, a universal curriculum that would function for all areas. So this was called the arts curriculum, and the backbone of the arts curriculum was philosophy. And Robert Grosseteste thought, actually, in the case of philosophy, because Plato's not an option, because Seneca wrote great letters and small treatises, but he's problematic from a Christian point of view, because he says the best thing is to, for instance, live virtuous lives, but, you know, irrespective of pain, right? So this is not exactly a Christian point of view. And you need something that's going to appeal to Christians, obviously, because it's being a Christian society. And you need something that is covering all areas. Then you need something that's comprehensive and systematic. And that's Aristotle. So what areas does Aristotle actually cover in his philosophy? You know this already. Number one. We've talked about it with Boethius. What area was that?
Logic.
Okay, yeah. See, someone was listening. Logic. What are the other three?
Natural philosophy.
Yes, exactly. Which is not quite the same as science. Because, actually, natural philosophy studies more the principles behind what happens in the physical world. Okay, it's not actually necessarily breaking things down and figuring out what materials are the components of stones and so on. So it's the principles and causes of nature. What else?
Moral
philosophy, which again also does something similar for the area of human action. And we're just missing one. What's beyond the natural world? And beyond in Greek is meta.
Metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so by 1250, Robert Grosseteste has taken the logical works translated by Boethius, retranslated them into Latin for his own time, just like we retranslate the Bible every few years as language changes. He takes the works of physics and natural philosophy, does the same thing with those, and with moral philosophy and metaphysics. These three here had not been translated really until that point. Okay. So what he does is he provides people a translation into Latin, but it's a very, very literal translation. It's a very technical translation. It's not meant to be the New York Times number one bestseller, because actually it is something that people are going to be studying in order to get something very specific and technical out of it. The idea is that philosophy is a technical subject, just like law is a technical subject and medicine is a technical subject and theology is a technical subject, right? So there's really very little sense that you have to somehow adapt things to sort of very wide audience. Okay, that may seem very straightforward, but it's actually very important for what we're going to talk about next.
So David, yeah. With these writings available, I mean, he was obviously, he could read Greek.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Which not many people could.
Yes, that's right.
But were these works actually available, but he was the first one to translate them?
Yes, there were a few copies available, but Robert Grosseteste came into contact with people with Greek manuscripts.
Right.
There were a few places in Europe, in Spain and in Oxford, where this contact was facilitated because of various circumstances.
Did the Arabs have some of these documents?
Very good. The Arabs had also translated at the same time, well, before this, they had translated most of the corpus of Aristotle, except for aspects of the moral philosophy. The politics in particular, they didn't translate because they were very iffy about what that politics might actually suggest to people in terms of actually actual sedition. Yeah. So the politics they didn't, but most of the other works they did. And so many of these translators in the 13th century, and there were others in the 12th century as well, that we have fragments of, actually started with had in front of them Arabic and Greek versions, which they could sometimes compare, at least through intermediaries, through other people who maybe were Arabic speaking, and could tell them what a text meant. There were also some Hebrew translations, very few Hebrew translations. Yeah. So it's quite wide-ranging, the linguistic possibilities. And furthermore, towards the end of the 13th century, you have versions of these works, of some of these works at least, circulating in the vernacular. So you have versions in French, versions in Italian. Brunetto Latini is maybe one of the most famous French authors. He's Italian, but he's writing in French. Niccolò Rem, later on in the 14th century, very interested in natural philosophy, and writes the translation into French. So this is not just for the people in the universities, but it is mainly for the people in the universities. And therefore things tend to be very, very scholastically laid out, okay? Laid out for their learning. Actually, one of the interesting things about these works is that we have lots of surviving manuscripts of people who were looking at Aristotle, and you can see how densely annotated the first few pages, especially of those manuscripts, are. And they don't necessarily carry on those dense annotations later on, because I think what's happening is that the teachers are concentrating on giving people methodology. Okay, I will sit with you and for several weeks or months, we will go through this particular section of this work, right? And by the time we've done that very carefully and very deeply, you'll have gotten such a sense of how to do that that you can go off and do it on your own. So there's a, but there are some people, scholars like Thomas Aquinas, Albert the Great in the 13th century, both of them, and then later on others, who do write full commentaries on these works, and then they get studied by people in religious schools, in universities, and outside of them. So they have this whole range of commentary.
Was it translated into English at all? Was it just...
It gets translated into English very late. Very, very late. In 16th century. Up until then, because the English were so proficient in Latin and French, don't forget French.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Actually, a lot of works the English didn't bother translating at all into their own language until much later. French works very, very well for lots of them. So we have something to thank William the Conqueror for, I guess. Okay, anyone have any questions on this so far? Commentary tradition?
Just on the teaching, was there a lot of rote learning, or was it a real sort of dialogue? Or do we know how to teach?
We have images. In which you have the teacher with a club, holding a club.
And don't get any ideas. Let's drop it.
This is a very, very. And you have then the pupils, obviously on their benches or on the floor. But that's a schoolroom situation for the younger ones, as they. As they advance in their teens, they would be studying these things, because initially, obviously, they would be learning how to read and write and learning the very rudiments of logic before going on to the other points. But actually, there is something this very, very important that James raises, which is what we know is that logic functions as a methodological tool throughout the whole curriculum. And so if you look at the commentaries, and if you look at not only the works of philosophy, but also the works of law and medicine and theology, what you'll find is that people are very, very careful to build an argument according to the rules of logic, and to avoid false syllogisms, and to be careful to prove things very, very carefully. So evidence is really important. So you could say that philosophy works according to a logical method that is derived almost entirely from Aristotle, although there's another author as well who's important, never mind. And these completely govern the way people are learning, and the way in which they distinguish something false from something that's true. And so you find this as a quick example for those who might remember. Last year we talked about Thomas Aquinas and the proofs for the existence of God. In that particular document, he says the existence of God can be proved by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think there are 5 proofs, right? And then he goes into detail into each one and says how the existence of God can be proved. On that particular basis. That's all done on the basis of logic. Right? And so that's just an example of the use of logic in theology. But you have that in medicine, you have it in law, as I was saying, and in other fields.
So does rhetoric come out of logic?
I'm glad you brought that up. Now, rhetoric is really important and interesting because Aristotle writes a work on rhetoric, but it's not really well known during this period. He also writes a work on poetics, and that's not known for quite a while, until the end of the 15th century. So rhetoric does get studied, but not necessarily on the basis of Aristotle, this is where Anna Laura actually does know something.
Don't say anything.
But on the basis of other models and authors, such as...
Cicero.
Exactly. So Cicero, the Cicero that we were looking at before, right? Cicero, who delivered these wonderful orations, right, in defense and in prosecution. He is a model of rhetorical style, but there are other models from antiquity as well. Quintilian, for instance. Those are probably two of the most important ones, Quintilian and Cicero. You agree? Anna Laura?
Yeah.
Yeah? So that's not so much based on Aristotle's works, which are actually more theory anyway, on rhetoric. These works are more models of style. This is how you write. Okay? Now, this rhetoric is actually part of a lower step, which actually includes... I almost made the elementary mistake of spelling grammar with an E. rhetoric and grammar together actually are the entry point to the educational system, right? Grammar is reading the works of the ancient. It's not what we think of today. It's actually learning Latin through reading the works of the ancients, especially the good models, the models of Latin. Rhetoric is instead the art of public speaking, right? And speaking eloquently. This is something that's developing a lot in the 13th and 14th century. You remember the rise of the city-states, for instance, in Italy and elsewhere, the courts, and the importance of ambassadors going from one place to the other. Increasingly, you really... how can we translate this into English? Fare bella figura. It's a typical Italian expression. Fare bella figura. You really impress people by actually delivering your orations in Latin. Yeah? Mm-hmm. That becomes even more important later on in the 15th century. But think about this as a ladder of studies. You enter... you start your educational curriculum here, then actually you go here, logic, natural philosophy, moral philosophy, physics, more or less. But also, so this is a curriculum that's standard for the arts throughout Europe, along with mathematics and astrology. But actually, keep in mind that within this particular curriculum here, especially, some places are more dedicated to doing some subjects than others. In covering. So natural philosophy gets covered everywhere in Europe. Moral philosophy gets covered very strongly in England and Central Europe and France, but very, very hit and miss in Italy. That's why we have the politicians that we do. And metaphysics is actually quite absent in the Italian universities for a very long time. Partly because metaphysics is something that's tied together with the study of theology, and Italian universities do not regularly teach theology in this period at all. But in other parts of Europe, it's very strong. Okay? So just think about the fact that there are all kinds of regional variations, let's say. Yeah. And another variation that's important to think about, coming back to James's point about teaching, is that teaching is delivered through two main means. One is lecturing, we're all familiar with. Although, in some cases, people lectured slowly enough that, in fact, it amounted to dictating. And so we have lectures, surviving lectures, which we know word for word what was said in the classroom, which is quite interesting. Some statutes of the universities prohibited this, but... people did it anyway. Yeah, it was easy to recycle from one year to the next. Yeah, and secondly, the question or debate format. So, if I were to say to pose a question for the class, such as, "What is the final cause of?" putrefaction process? Yeah? Or what are the four main causes of putrefaction? Is there a material cause, an efficient cause, a final cause, and which cause am I? The formal cause. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Those are the four main causes of the Aristotelian system that influence natural philosophy, right? We could have a debate. James might say, well, the final cause of putrefaction is this, and Kith might answer, well, actually, I object to your points 1, 2, and 3 on the basis of other authorities that I have, and because of logic, right? And so you'd have this debate in front of everyone. Of course, they would have the questions in advance, and they would prepare themselves. And then the master at the end would come in and say, well, James is right on points 1A, 2B, but Kith is right on these other points. And give his own solution of the problem.
So that's a bit like the letter that we read at the end, isn't it? He's putting his different points.
Exactly, exactly. That's very very good that you recognize that. So this is part of this scholastic method, let's say. Use of logic, often use of the questio, we call it in Latin, format with that raises debates and makes people also think on their feet. And and the other important point here is that philosophy is more important than grammar and rhetoric. Philosophy must be done according to a technical language because it's a technical subject and it's not open for everyone. Okay, now what happens? In the Renaissance, you've read a bit of this from Jim Hankins' introduction to Bruni. Did you remember that part in which he talks about the age of Plato and the age of Aristotle? Did that pass you by? I think it's on page 2 of did you not see that? I may be misremembering where it was exactly. We have prizes for people who can actually remember what page it was on. Okay, 259 and 260. Look at the bottom of 259. So he says, it used to be said, and one can still find it in certain textbooks and popular histories today, that the Middle Ages were an age of Aristotle and the Renaissance an age of Plato. Is that true or is that not true?
Not true.
Why not?
You walked into that.
Haven't we seen that the Middle Ages were an age of Aristotle?
Absolutely.
Or have we?
I actually thought that this one of your treatises at the very beginning of the very first course, that was one of the things I remember from
what?
The medieval time, the Middle Ages, were based on Aristotle's teaching. But then one of the big differences from the Renaissance was people got hold of Plato's works. So I interpreted these sentences that you read out on page 259
as being correct.
As being different from that.
As being different from that.
Because it says, logically, it used to be said.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Yes. What you had said. So I'm assuming.
This proves that I always completely fail at making this point. So what I've been trying to argue up to now is that in the medieval period, did you have any Platonism?
Yes.
Not much.
Boethius, Augustine, Cicero, plus all the interpretations that were based on those. There's a whole book now out on Boethius, commentaries on Boethius in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, right, proving that this is a long tradition. So there is a strain of Platonism, even though there are, it's true, 2.5 dialogues only of Plato circulating during this time. So there is a preponderance in the formal system of education of Aristotelian works, but at the same time, there's a whole circulation of Platonic works or Platonic-oriented works that also influenced, by the way, people like Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas' metaphysics and theology are strongly influenced by, colored by Platonic thought. Point one. Two, in the Renaissance, yes, there is a new movement towards recuperating the works of Plato, and so you finally have in the year first translation, complete translation of Plato's works of 14. Yes,
or 63?
No, this is 40. 1470s, I think, the complete translation of Plato's works by Ficino, Marsilio Ficino. So, and this is very important. But actually, does Platonism make it into the universities in a consistent way? As a textbook? No. Not usually. There are cases, and one of my colleagues would shoot me, but that's okay. There are some rare cases in which people do lecture on Plato, but actually, regularly, the whole idea is Plato's too unsystematic. So let's take Aristotle. We can always combine Aristotle with Plato in our lectures. That's absolutely not a problem, right? So on one level, there is this Platonism, which has mounted in importance, but at the same time, the interpretation of Aristotle becomes even more important than before. And so if you look at the number of commentaries, I forgot to bring that book, but if you look at the number of commentaries and translations of Aristotle in the period, in the Renaissance, they actually outnumber those from the previous period probably by 5 to 1. Yeah. So it's really considerable. And actually there's one interpretation that says that the reason that Aristotelianism eventually wanes in the 17th century is that there's such a load of commentary tradition. It basically breaks the camel's back. Yeah, it becomes so weighty and incredibly, almost too important. Yeah. So there's a really fundamental book about this. This is the nice thing about doing this class here is that I can bring all of my books. And this is the famous book by Charles B. Schmidt, which Ana Laura knows, called Aristotle and the Renaissance. I need to write one that's called Aristotle in the Renaissance, which would be different. But this is a very important book, and as you can see, it's not that big. 1983, Harvard University Press. The same thing, and he talks about the fact that Aristotle in the period, under so many different guises, becomes more and more important. So he is actually the most important pioneer in this field of showing that the Renaissance was not just this age of Plato, it was actually as much an age of Aristotle. And secondly, he emphasized something which is really important, which is that we're not talking about the tradition of Aristotelianism in the singular, but actually of various types and features of Aristotelianism. And so you can't talk about a single current or a single mode of people receiving Aristotle and commenting on Aristotle during that time. I'll sell you that copy, Lisa, for around 200.
200?
No, 500. See how much I can. We're going to start a bidding war. Yeah, on eBay. So, Aristotelianisms, the plurality of that movement, is actually quite important. And one of these strands, shall we say, is the continuation of what we've seen before, the mode of what we might call scholastic Aristotelianism, right? But increasingly, there are also new ones. So one might be the interpretation of Aristotle's works as we have seen, yeah, pure Aristotle. Another one might be the combination of this approach with the works of other commentators. Let's say, why don't we look at Aristotle in connection to both what the Arabs, for instance, have written on Aristotle, and what the Greeks have. I slightly misled you before, because when I was saying that the Aristotelian tradition remains actually quite isolated for those centuries between Boethius and the 13th century, that's not entirely true. Because if you think of the East, of the Greek tradition, Byzantium, actually Aristotle's works do continue to be read. And by the way, even more important than those works in the Greek context is Gazoo. Plato. They continue to read Plato and Aristotle and comment on them. And at the same time, in the West, you have these translations into Latin of the works of the Arabs. So eventually you have translation of the works of the Arabs and the translations of the works of the Greeks. And they're not always easy to reconcile. And they aren't always easy to reconcile with Christianity. So you can think about all of the problems that arise. Let me just give you an illustration. One single, very important problem, and that is the immortality of the soul. Aristotle nowhere says that the soul is immortal in a clear way. Plato, of course, does. For the Arab writers in the Muslim tradition, of course, it is important as well to have that idea to some extent. But there is this tension between what the Arab writers actually do acknowledge, and very often they say, well, Aristotle doesn't really support the immortality of the soul. The Greeks think that Aristotle's works are completely reconcilable with Christianity. And how you play those against one another is very complex. Okay?
So the translations are very subjective. Mm.
The translations are not objective as you might imagine. You're right, and they're not. That's the case for Aristotle as well as for Plato as well as for other authors. So Hankins, for instance, has shown that in the case of Plato, who talks about the community of women and other things in Republic Book 8, actually there's an attempt to silence him on these issues in which he seems to be against Christianity, right? So, and to instead insert things that are favorable to Christianity in his writing.
So would the West take their interpretation via the Greek?
They do both. Okay. So, for instance, the Greek commentaries get translated by our friend Grosseteste in the 13th century, right? Okay. At the same time, he doesn't know Arabic, but other people at the same time are translating those works from Arabic into Latin, and it becomes a whole problem. You know, how do you manage these very diverse traditions? You can imagine. I mean, it's just like being confronted with conflicting opinions by experts today.
Were the conflicting original texts? Yes. I mean, were they all working from one core text? Or
No, that's the other problem. Is you've got all of these different manuscripts all over the place. You don't have, of course, print until mid-15th century, and so you don't have a stable text. And even after print, you don't have a stable text for a very long time.
It raises an interesting question, sort of blurring the difference between translation and interpretation.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Absolutely.
What are you doing? Are you actually translating, or are you
interpreting through your own lens.
You always interpret as you translate, and you have to, because you have to solve ambiguities in the text, right? So you have to decide. You can't just put, like my students would like to do, you know, this word struck the other word in their translation. You've got to make a choice, right? And so that's what they do. They make a choice, and they make the best they're honest interpreters in the sense that they don't even realize that they're necessarily colored by prejudices or assumptions as they're translating. But looking back on it, you know, 700, 600, 500 years later, you actually realize, oh, wait, it's not nearly so simple. So that's one of the interesting things that we're doing in our project, is actually trying to figure out to what extent people are looking at, for instance, when they're translating into the vernacular, are they working from the Latin texts? Are they working from the Greek texts? How are they adapting their translations to their audience to make, for instance, their patron maybe...
Is it church and state as well?
Yeah, exactly. Patron. And especially if you're having a work of politics, which says, actually, it's not a very good idea to have a monarchy. Then you might need to adapt it.
Just a bit. Okay.
Assuming the patron reads it.
Yes.
He may not. Right. Yeah.
Did Aristotle also contradict himself in his writing? So people would find that difficult.
Yes. Well, the textual tradition is very, very complex for Aristotle's works. Many of the works come to us from his students, who were not paying attention always entirely, or the tradition is corrupt. And especially works, the pseudo-Aristotelian works, like the Problems, which went under the name of Aristotle, but we know almost certainly weren't written by Aristotle. And there are lots of these pseudo-Aristotelian works, actually completely a mess, and they contradict each other on various points. So that makes it really difficult. Okay, so you have these, and at least a third current, but there are many more, is the humanist current that we're looking at today. And what does a humanist current actually want to do? What do people think from their reading and from their general knowledge?
Sorry, what was the question?
What do the humanists want to do with Aristotle? Where are the humanists? Let's start there, and then work forwards. Where does the work come from? Remember, those of you from the past should remember. I'm sure Lisa remembers.
I'm not from the past.
No. That's a good answer.
There were people who wanted to revive the ancient learning, but in a different way from how it had been followed and thought about in medieval times.
Okay, help me with the etymology, though, dear.
So,
remember? What are two different etymologies of the term humanist?
Humanus?
Sorry?
Humanus?
Yes, exactly. So the one might be humanus, which means person, right? Mm-hmm. Or mankind. So these might be... if you're thinking in terms of disciplines, you might think of studies that are proper to man. Isn't that Samuel Johnson? Is it? Anyway. And then, what's the other one? Just right next to it. Actually, very close. School of Arts, or we call it also School of the
Humanities.
Good. What's that game in which you you try to get the other people to guess the word? You should play that. humanities, right? And so these are two different interpretations of where that term humanism comes from, right? But let's take for now this one, the humanities, as our indicator, let's say, of an cultural educational orientation. Yeah? What are these people trying to stress? They're trying to stress those arts and the humanities that are especially relevant to public life, learning and public life, that are common to a lot of people. And these are, fundamentally, grammar and rhetoric, and closely allied to those poetry, right? So, I don't think you would be surprised if a colleague of mine, a mathematician, came to you next week or the following week and said, actually, the most important aspect of the Renaissance period and of the studies today is mathematics. Yeah? Not surprising at all. This is what the humanists come and say. Actually, the most important part of the curriculum is grammar and rhetoric. Remember that part? That was the most elementary of all. Yeah, in the former system. That becomes the most important. And the other aspects that we talked about, philosophy, for instance, they become less important, or at least subordinate, to these interests in grammar, rhetoric, and poetry. Because, actually, remember how logic was the methodology for scholasticism? What becomes the methodology for humanism, for interpreting everything, are these two of grammar and rhetoric. So it's not that they don't want to study philosophy. It's fine to study philosophy, and we'll see in a moment after the break how Bruni does that. But the main point is you don't study it according to the tools of logic alone. Actually, you have a different system, a different approach in which that philosophy has to speak a certain language of the ancients. That is a language, in this case, the best language of the Golden Age of Latin, which is the age, which is the language of Cicero. Okay. So I think we'll stop here, have our break. That's plenty for people to take in till now. Then we'll continue our discussion in about 10 minutes. Yeah? Do you have enough time to pull out your Boethius? Catch up on your wrist.
Hope you pause it.